Did you know a single finger prick at home can give you over 180 personalized insights into how to improve your health and slow your aging? As soon as you try the True Age plus True Health test by True Diagnostic, it will show you things you've never learned from a standard doctor's visit or your annual physical. The True Age plus True Health test is a simple at-home kit that gives you powerful insights so you can feel better longer. True Health looks at over 105 biomarkers tied to your nutritional, metabolic, immune, and cognitive health. TrueAge measures 75 plus biomarkers to reveal your biological age, your pace of aging, and the age of key organ systems. It doesn't just give you a single number. It shows you how your heart, brain, liver, and immune system are aging. Together, the combo gives you a complete picture of your health today, along with personalized recommendations that will give you the largest bang for buck improvements to your health and to slow down aging. It's all done at home with just a quick, painless finger prick. If you're serious about living healthier and longer, visit truediagnostic.com and use my code INVEST for 20% off your entire order or subscription. That's truediagnostic.com, code INVEST for 20% off. Your future self will thank you.
On radio, on YouTube, streaming live on investtalk.com, and for our podcast subscribers, this is Invest Talk. Independent thinking, shared success. Invest Talk is made possible by KPP Financial, a registered investment advisor firm serving clients throughout the United States. Here is KPP Financial Portfolio Manager, Luke Guerrero.
Good afternoon, fellow investors, and welcome back to Invest Talk. I'm your host, Luke Guerrero, and today is Tuesday, September 23rd, 2025. Now, there are only 5 trading days left in this quarter, so the fourth quarter is right around the corner. And before you know it, you'll be celebrating the holidays with your family, and look at that, it's already 2026. And so looking back on 2025 thus far, the proof is in the pudding. Things change rapidly. And so we as investors cannot afford to lose focus, because as the world changes, as markets digest what is changing, your portfolios are certainly affected. And so we here at InvestTalk believe that our goal, our singular objective, is that each and every day when you listen, you leave just a slightly better, slightly more informed investor. Now, in order to accomplish that or seek to accomplish that task, we bring a mixture of educational items and actionable material each and every day. But the most important part of the show is, of course, your finance and investment questions. So before we talk about today's market performance and run down those topics, let's tackle this caller question now.
This is Bobby from Atlanta, Georgia. What do you guys think of XPO Logistics? Is it a good time to buy or still probably a little bit more downside? We'll listen to the answer on the next show. Thank you.
XPO is a logistics company that operates primarily in North America, though they do have a bit of European exposure as well. 61-39 is that revenue breakdown there. And so what they do is they deal in freight and transportation with a strong focus on less than truckload freight. What does that mean? Well, essentially it is generally combining many different companies' freight into various truckloads. It is less than a truckload. They serve about 99% of US zip codes in their LTL network in the United States. They also, again, operate in Europe. They do last mile contract logistics, freight forwarding, and overall manage supply chain services. Now, they spun off their contract logistics segment in 2021, and so it became a bit more narrowly focused, which tends to, especially with logistics companies, benefit by having that more narrow focus. In the past 2 months, the stock is up 7.11%, up 1.62% year to date, up 17.83% over the past 52 weeks, and it's seen a bit of stability. It's seen moderate strength as sentiment within the freight and logistics space has improved a little bit. This company's had a bit of margin expansion as well. EBITDA margin up from 9.2% coming out of the pandemic, projected to be about 15.6% this upcoming year. They've also been working on cost efficiency, on network optimization, on leveraging scale within their operations. And so it's rallied from its lows earlier in the year. It was trading at about 96.42 in April, right after Liberation Day. Now trading at about 133.28, putting it at a price to forward-looking earnings of 30.1 times, near its five-year high, 37, well above its average of 21.8, trading at 18.6 times price to cash flow, 2 times price to sales, all in the upper end of its range there. And so what do we want to look for? Well, freight volumes. How many shipments are they getting as we move into next year? Cost pressures. Gas is becoming more expensive. Diesel is becoming more expensive. Parts are becoming more expensive. Insurance is becoming more expensive. How are these inputs going to potentially squeeze margins? How efficient is their network? Are there capacity constraints? Overall, their guidance has been okay. It's been solid. Again, coming out of sentiment being very poor just 5 months ago. But there is certainly some cyclical risk here. Freight demand is cyclical. Economic slowdown can reduce volumes. They are set to report earnings again in about a month. Given where these valuations are relative to where they've been, given the elevated pricing here on this climb back due to sentiment, and given the cyclical risks, probably wouldn't invest in this company right now. Looks a little bit too expensive. Certainly would wait to see and be interested to see what they expect over the next 6 months in their forward-looking guidance set for the end of October. That is XPO, one to certainly keep your eye on, XPO Inc. Thanks for the call. We got a lot of ground to cover in the next 45 minutes or so, and here's some of what we have planned for you all. My main focus point concerns this story: top four signs you're over-diversified in your portfolio. Owning too many overlapping investments can water down returns, so we'll explain how spreading your portfolio too thin may create more risk than protection. We'll also touch on the speech that Jerome Powell gave describing rates as modestly restrictive, keeping the door open a bit for cuts, but still some worry about inflation. We'll also touch on the crypto space. A lot of crypto companies, crypto treasury companies, not doing too hot, turning to share buybacks to try and push falling stock prices. So as those get more and more news, you should certainly be concerned about those types of companies. Should we have time at the end of the show? We'll touch on how different generations invest and what understanding those types of mindsets can do for you. We also have some voicemail questions ready to play, including one on PANW, Palo Alto Networks, and another on tax loss harvesting, as well as some questions that came in from the comment section of the InvestTalk YouTube channel, and hopefully some live questions from some of you throughout the show. We're headed into a break. On the other side of this quick break, we'll talk about today's market activity. But please remember, you can call in anytime and leave your questions on the InvestTalk Voice Bank. And if you're listening via our live stream or possibly on AM 1220 in the Bay Area, call now at 888-99-CHART.
Get ready for an all-new InvestTalk Wealth Webinar, Beyond the Mag 7. How to identify AI opportunities across sectors. Justin Klein and Luke Guerrero are going to help you move past the familiar names to identify the key opportunities for investment in the real AI revolution. They'll be talking about the energy grid, data center infrastructure, and how AI is boosting profits in a wide range of industries. The all-new InvestTalk Wealth Webinar, happening online September 30th from 1 to 2 p.m. Pacific Time. Seats are limited, so register now at investtalk.com. There's value in every InvestTalk podcast, so call InvestTalk 888-99-CHART. The InvestTalk phone lines never close. And now Luke Guerrero is here taking your calls live. InvestTalk, 888-99-CHART.
888-99-CHART is the number if you want to get through live to me sometime in the next 50 minutes. But before we get to our next question, let's talk a little bit about the market. Today, the Dow down 19 basis points, S&P 500 down 55, NASDAQ down 95, Russell 2000 down 24. Pretty broadly negative day overall. Interestingly enough, though, breadth was positive. The equal weight S&P 500 outperformed the cap-weighted index by 65 basis points, so it closed at a positive 10 basis points on the day. So why was the S&P down? Well, big tech, all lower. Amazon, Nvidia, some of the notable decliners. Other underperformers included software, pharma, exchanges, restaurants, housing, linked retail, and telecom names. Outperformers included energy, banks, media, credit cards, asset managers, department stores, and apparel manufacturers. On the bond side, treasuries a bit firmer across the curve, yields down 2 to 4 basis points, the dollar index down 10 basis points, gold finishing up yet again up 1.1% after a nearly 2% rally on Monday, closing at a fresh record high above the 3,800 level. At the same time, Bitcoin, which some people dub digital gold, but seems to not really move in the same way the gold does, down 50 basis points on the day. Crude oil settling up 1.8%, though off of best levels. So what really was the big mover today? Well, the big story was a reversal of what we saw in Monday's price action. AI, big tech leading to the downside and risk-off pockets, those treasuries, those gold, those defensives, doing a bit better, a continuation of the rotation that we did see a bit last week. More scrutiny around AI capex, around return on investment and monetization in the headlines, though none of that is new. It's been quite some time. The market and participants have been talking about, hey, these companies have spent a lot of money and have not seen much, if any, return. So that will continue to weigh on market sentiment, probably more and more headed into next year. Nothing really new from Jerome Powell, though. We'll talk a bit about what he said. The market's still continuing to price in 40 basis points of cuts through year end, and even an additional 75 basis points in 2026. But you're seeing a bit of Fed dispersion. Bowman, Moran, the new Fed governor, and fears that the market is getting ahead of the Fed's rate cut projections continues to get attention, right? The expectation versus reality is what drives markets. If inflation peaks up again, if the labor market starts to heat up again, the economy looks stronger, maybe we don't get those 40 basis points of cuts this year. Geopolitics in the headlines, again, the president shifting his tone pretty dramatically on Ukraine, saying it can win its war against Russia and take back lost territory, and that it will have the support of the European Union and NATO. The economic front, U.S. flash manufacturing and service PMIs, largely in line. The release noted higher costs from tariffs, but limited scope for price hikes due to weaker demand and competitive pressures. September Richmond Fed Manufacturing Index dropped a bit further than expected, with notable falls in shipments, new orders, and employment. And a Treasury auction of $69 billion in twos, fairly well received today, stopped through by 10 basis points. Notable, though, foreign demand below what we've seen in recent sales. So certainly as the government continues to roll over a lot of debt, issue new Treasuries, going to be interesting to see if foreign demand continues to be a bit dampened moving forward. Let's move back to the InvestTalk voice bank for this question that came in earlier to 888-99-CHART.
Hey guys, this is Chance in Knoxville, Tennessee. I can honestly say I wouldn't be investing on my own without your podcast, so I really appreciate you guys. My question is regarding tax lots. When selling shares, how do you decide which tax lots to sell? I understand there are probably a multitude of scenarios, but I'm having trouble making that decision when I'm looking at trimming profits, for example. If you could provide some general guidance around this, I would love to hear your advice. Thanks.
Awesome. Great question. So for those of you who don't understand, a tax lot is the amount of shares and the price at which you bought them on a given day. Because you can buy shares in a company at many different times. But when you end up selling those shares, the gain that you realize is done on a lot level. And so it does matter sometimes what lots you are selling. And there's many different methodologies. There's FIFO, which is first in, first out, meaning the first shares you bought are the first ones you sell. There's LIFO, meaning last in, first out, the last shares you bought are the first you sell. There's highest cost basis, lowest cost basis, all sorts of things you can do. What are the benefits? Well, if you are doing FIFO, first in, first out, it is more likely that you're going to be selling something that is a long-term hold versus a short-term hold, the opposite true in LIFO. Now, what we do is, and what a lot of managers do, institutional managers do, is it depends what it's called, but it's essentially least tax impact. And so what that means is if you're selling something at a loss, it's going to sell the thing that is at the most loss. If you are selling something at a gain, it's going to sell something at the least amount of gain. Now, that doesn't mean it's going to sell something that is the highest price, right? Because it could be that selling something with a lower price at a long-term gain is going to be more tax beneficial than selling something at a higher price at a short-term gain. So it doesn't look at the gain itself. It looks at the tax impact of that gain. And if you're using a broker, there is a likely chance, especially the big guys, the Schwabs, the Fidelities, all these guys, that you can set something similar. Over time, things become and have less of a tax impact, be it because you're doing short-term versus long-term or what have you, or because those shares are passed on. Either way, anytime you're trimming, anytime you're selling, you always need to take into consideration what the tax implications are going to be. So there's least tax impact, where you're either taking the least amount of taxable gains or harvesting the most amount of losses, I think is the most efficient way or the most efficient lot relief methodology in any portfolio. Moving into breaks, so to come, my main focus point, more answers to your questions, and hopefully some live calls, but that cannot happen without you. We already have our first live call, James from New York, who we will get to after the break. You could be the person to follow them at 888-99-CHART.
...2025 rolls on, and you might have some fresh questions for Justin or Luke. Call InvestTalk, 888-99-CHART.
Let's go to James from New York, who has a question about Infosys. Do you own it, or are you looking to buy it?
I'm thinking of buying it, but I want to get some international exposure. But I know this is probably a very cyclical name. Do you think that this is maybe a good time in the current state to enter a position like this? Or I think it's at good support levels here, but what do you think?
Yeah, great question. This is actually a name we looked at, I want to say the end of last year for a bit. Infosys, ticker INFY. It's an ADR. It's an Indian tech consulting company. They're pretty well diversified across the types of businesses that they're consulting for. Their top ones being about 28% of their revenue from financial services, 15% from manufacturing, and 14% from retail. So what they essentially do is they go in, they help with sort of digital transformation for cloud AI, analytics, automation, in all of these different service verticals. Now, they have recently approved a share buyback, their largest ever, about $2 billion over the past 3 months, which has led to a little bit better performance over the past 3 months versus the previous six. Because year to date, they're down about 23% over the past 3 months. They're only down about 6.7%, which makes sense, right? Anytime you have share repurchases, you have a floating of the share price just a little bit. Now, you know, one thing that may weigh on this a little bit is changes to U.S. visas, H-1B fees. And so that's raised a little bit of concern for Indian IT firms, including Infosys, which may weigh a bit on outsourcing costs and profitability. They have had some strong performance. Revenue beat expectations in Q3, and they did raise their full year revenue. Their demand, it seems, their growth within financial services still remains a bit solid, but there's still some headwinds. Macro headwinds, regulation, regulatory risk, immigration risks have certainly grown, which has been maybe beating back a little bit of investor sentiment to the point that they're trading near the low end of their forward-looking price to earnings. over the past 5 years, about 20.9 forward-looking price to earnings, price to cash flow 16 times, which again, for a consulting company within the cloud space, those are pretty low multiples. They're outperforming their industry by about 1.2% year to date, but you know, that's not really saying much considering they're underperforming the S&P this year by 36. They've actually underperformed each of the past 4 years. So, you know, I think there are a lot of issues here. I think in the short term, there's execution risk, again, policy risk, and overall, a bit of washout within the AI consulting space that just make it to me seem like, well, this thing is falling for a reason. Really doesn't have a good price trend. Maybe it's trying to stabilize in the 16 to 17% range after or $16 to $17 range after having a big downward trajectory going back to last year. But frankly, I just think the macro headwinds out there are a little too much to the point where I wouldn't really want to invest in an international consulting company that's trying to do a bunch of work and has a bunch of revenue exposure to North America, about 58% of its revenue exposure. So for now, I think I would pass on INFY, Infosys. Thanks for the call. Let's go to a voicemail that came in earlier to 888-99-CHART.
Hello, guys. I wanted to know what you guys thought about PANW, Palo Alto Networks. I was comparing the company to others in the cybersecurity sector, and it seems to be one of the best. I'm willing to be patient on it, but wanted to see what you guys think is a good entry point. Thanks. Love the show.
PANW, Palo Alto Networks, is a network security solutions company headquartered in the United States, up near Palo Alto, go figure. Past three months, down about 3 basis points, pretty much flat. Still up 11.7% year-to-date, up 18.11%. Over the past 52 weeks, relative strength compared to the S&P 500, gangbusters going back to 2019. That's because it is a big theme. Cybersecurity is one of the largest themes, certainly over the past 10, 15 years. Cybersecurity risk in all sorts of companies, healthcare, industrials, all sorts of companies, becoming very, very important. So they offer next-gen firewalls, cloud security, AI-driven security, identity security, all things that are, again, very, very important. In the past 3 months, they had the CyberArk acquisition announcement, though that did trigger a bit of concerns over dilution, valuations. Overall, you know, their core businesses continue to show pretty solid demand, about 63% of their revenue from the United States, 21% from Europe, big revenue from that subscription business, about 54% of their revenue following that subscription model. Over the past 6 months, they've also benefited from the growth in cybersecurity spending overall. Their valuations really reflecting this broad requirements, again, across industries, not just from their firewall, but all these companies that have a lot of AI ambitions needing that extra layer of security as well. Now, margins at the same time, right, have fallen a bit from 32%, projected to be 12.3%, this upcoming year. And so does it justify their valuation of 53 times forward-looking earnings? That's a bit expensive. There's 7.5% short interest out there for a reason. This name has been volatile since October, up and down, trying to find some sort of trend here. Given those elevated valuations, 39.7 times cash flow, 16 times price to sales, I'd probably keep this on my watch list for now, although it fits into a great theme. Really trying to find a direction here. That is Palo Alto Networks, ticker PANW. We're headed into break. On the other side, we will get to my main focus point and more of your questions. You're listening to Invest Talk. Give me a call at 888-99-CHART.
The all-new Invest Talk Wealth Webinar. Beyond the Mag 7, how to identify...
You know your business inside and out. Gusto knows payroll, compliance, and benefits as well, so you don't have to. Sounds like a match made in heaven, right? Gusto is online payroll and benefits software built for small businesses. It's all in one, remote friendly, and incredibly easy to use, so you can pay, hire, onboard, and support your team from anywhere. Gusto helps you save time with automated tools built right in. Offer letters, onboarding materials, direct deposit, and more. Automatic payroll tax filing, simple direct deposits, health benefits, commuter benefits, workers' comp, 401k, you name it. Gusto makes it simple and has options for nearly every budget. Get direct access to certified HR experts to help support you through any tough HR situation. It's quick and simple to switch to Gusto. Just transfer your existing data to get up and running fast. Plus, don't pay a cent until you run your first payroll. Try Gusto today at gusto.com/investtalk and get 3 months free when you run your first payroll. That's 3 months of free payroll at gusto.com/investtalk. One more time, gusto.com/investtalk.
By AI opportunities across sectors. Join Justin and Luke as they talk about the energy grid, data center infrastructure, and how AI is boosting profits in a wide range of industries. The InvestTalk Wealth Webinar, September 30th, 1 to 2 p.m. Pacific Time. Online seats are limited, so register now at investtalk.com.
On the next Invest Talk, we will look into this story, Trump's H-1B visa fee and its impact on the U.S. economy. The new $100,000 H-1B visa fee could discourage companies from hiring foreign workers, potentially affecting U.S. businesses, innovation, and overall economic growth. That's tomorrow. But for now, I'm Lou Guerrero, and I'm ready to talk about the top four signs you've over-diversified your portfolio. Owning too many overlapping investments can water down returns. So let's dive into how spreading your portfolio too thin may create more risk than protection. Now, as everybody knows, diversification, as they say, is the only free lunch in investing. It's a cornerstone of portfolio management. But when you take it too far, it can certainly backfire. And when people think about overly diversifying, it's something that I actually mentioned when we talked about the company XPO at the top of the show. I think that was the ticker. In that they sold one of their businesses in order to really focus. And so corporate people have often said that diversification is when you diversify too much, you don't know what you're doing, things become overly complex. And that can describe some portfolios as well. It can dilute returns, it can add costs, and it can certainly increase complexity. We live in the golden age of ETF investing. But having too many overlapping funds or even stocks can turn diversification from that risk management piece into really a mediocre portfolio. Now, some advisors over-diversify for self-interest, for job security, for fear of underperformance, or to generate fees through constant money in motion. That's why we always preach, it's something that we practice as well, going to a fee-only advisor who does not get commissions, who does not get paid based on turnover, but only gets paid based on assets under management. Like I said, there are a lot of ETFs out there, a lot of mutual funds out there, and mutual funds often look different by name, but hold the exact same stock. So piling them together only adds cost without new diversification. If you want a tool that can really help you see what these funds are doing, Morningstar Stylebox can help you spot whether your funds are clustered into the same exact categories. Now, multi-manager products like fund to funds or target date funds provide that quick diversification, but they tend to have higher costs. They have diluted oversight because they're just buying individual funds themselves. They don't have access to the underlying investment managers and provide less customization. The Madoff scandal actually highlighted the hidden risks of exactly what I'm talking about. Investors unknowingly held his funds via multi-manager vehicles that were buried in layers and layers of complexity, and people didn't really realize what they were owning. Too many individual stocks also pose problems. Endless due diligence on those companies, messy taxes, and index-like returns at a higher cost, not just in money, but also in time. Now, experts disagree about what the magic, quote-unquote magic, number is. Some suggest that 10 to 30 seems to be the magic number. Others later call for over 100, but most agree that broad industry coverage matters more than raw count. And now we're talking about other forms of diversification, not just looking at different equity companies, public equities, but alternatives as well. Private equity, non-traded real estate. They can mislead more than they can help. Because a lot of these investments are private, it means that as market conditions change, the values of those funds don't change because things aren't marked to market. It can smooth returns, make it seem like volatility is lower. They have opaque valuations. They can overstate their overall correlations and diversification benefits. The bottom line here is that investors should scrutinize what they own, why they own it, and whether each additional holding in their portfolio truly adds value. Otherwise, that diversification can slip into that de-worsification. Let's pivot back to the InvestTalk Voice Bank and take a question that came in earlier to 888-99-CHART.
Hi, Doctor from New York. Thank you for all that you do. My question is about a way to invest into gold. I have two stock tickers that I would like for you to kind of compare. First one is Newmont Corporation, NEM. And if you can compare that to Barrick Gold, which is the letter B, I think that's what it is. I only have about like $500 I want to utilize to this. So let me know if I could choose one or if I could do both of them as well. But looking forward to the answer on the podcast. Have a great day. Bye.
Newmont Corporation, NEM, is an exploration and acquirer of gold properties. They don't just mine gold. They also mine copper. They mine, what else do they mine? They mine silver. They mine lead. Their business is geographically located kind of all over the place. 15% of their revenue comes from the United States. 25% of their revenue comes from Australia. 14% of their revenue comes from Canada. It's a fairly large company, right? $92 billion market cap company. They pay a pretty solid dividend. That dividend yield has ranged from 1.2 to 5% over the years. But given the price movement here, sitting at about 1.2% this year. Year to date, the company's up 127%, up 42% in the past 3 months, up 55% in the past 52 weeks. Let's take a look at Barrick Gold. So Barrick Mining Corporation is, again, a company that engages in the production and sale of gold, copper, and other related minerals. Now, they're far less diversified in terms of their geographic segment, 51% of their revenue coming from the United States, 11% from the Dominican Republic, 2% from Canada. Similar returns here, up 122% year to date, up 70% over the past 52 weeks. Fairly similar size, $60 billion market cap company. So what are really the differences here? Well, Newmont is one of the world's largest gold producers. Barrick's certainly a major producer as well. Newmont, again, has a broader global footprint, I would say, than Barrick, which is a bit more concentrated in Argentina, Canada, the United States. For Newmont, gold is pretty core, right? Other metals are just byproducts here, where Barrick is a little bit different. Barrick has both gold and copper as more explicitly part of their production profile. They both are pretty stable. They both have, you know, Newmont has a bit larger scale, a bit stronger balance sheet. Barrick, a bit smaller, can benefit from the growth from leverage that they have because their balance sheet is a bit weaker. But to me, it really comes down to what you are looking for. If you prefer more defensive mining exposure, somewhat less speculative, Newmont is likely safer. If you're aiming for more upside, you're more comfortable with volatility. You want a bit more diversification in what they are producing because copper is a core part of their business. I would go with Barrick. So both these companies are good companies. We have owned both of these companies for clients on and off over the years. It really just comes down to what you're looking for, what level of volatility you can stomach, and how defensive you want to be versus looking for growth. That is Barrick Mining versus Newmont, both great companies. Thanks for the call. See if we make it two in a row. This one about dollar cost averaging.
Just a quick question on dollar cost averaging in today's market. I have about 30% of my portfolio essentially in cash at the moment and want to get that back into my diversified ETF portfolio, a mixture of small, mid, and large caps. And just curious if you would dollar cost average that over a short amount of time, say the next 10 weeks, or would you dollar cost average that on a more lengthy timeline, say 20 plus weeks with the current market conditions? Just love your input on that in general, and we'll look forward on the podcast. Thanks so much.
That's a great question. So I think the most important thing relative to trying to time when to do it is that you do it and you set a plan and you execute it. Presumably, you are going to have more cash coming in as you earn income, more money for investing, meaning down the road, you have more potential to have more money that you can allocate towards your savings, allocate towards the markets. But, you know, given the current valuations, I understand your hesitance here. Historically speaking, the end of the year tends to be a bit slower. The returns of the year tend to be a bit amplified. In years where the market is down, people tend to sell even more to tax loss harvest. And so given the dynamics, given the end of the year, I understand the inclination to want to draw out this process a little bit and diversify and dollar cost average a bit more slowly. Given the scale of the year, given, you know, a lot of the potential headwinds, I understand the desire to do it a little bit over a longer time frame. As long as you make a plan and you stick to that plan, over long periods of time, dollar cost averaging can certainly be beneficial. Thanks for the call. Looks like we got a live call from Thomas from Santa Cruz, who has a question about PSCE. You own it? Are you looking to buy it?
Well, I bought a little bit of it today. I own a lot of oil and energy companies. It's something that I have pretty heavily in my portfolio. And I'm 28 years old, looking to buy and hold for a pretty long period of time, hopefully. And I was just wondering about a fund like this, a small cap fund, compared to the larger energy companies in the world. For someone who is younger, holding them longer, what's the upside to holding this compared to some of the larger companies, like, I mean, Occidental Petroleum, Chevron, Exxon, companies more like that?
Yeah, it's a great question. Let me ask, actually, what is your current weight in energy and, across your portfolio?
It's around probably 10%.
Okay.
I know that it's, something around there.
No, that's pretty reasonable. If you're going to tell me that you had 30% of your portfolio in oil, I would say, well, don't buy this, but you don't. And, you know, people tend to allocate towards energy because it isn't the biggest of growers, but it is a great income sector, especially if you're looking for broad sector allocation there. But 10%, perfectly reasonable. Let's take a look at the Invesco S&P Small Cap Energy ETF. So the first thing you got to know about this fund and any ETF is, how do they construct it? So PSCE is the energy segment of the S&P Small Cap 600. Now, if you listened to yesterday's show, I believe it was, we got a question about a fund that tracked a Small Cap 600 as well. And I mentioned that the difference between S&P and the Russell 2000, for example, which is a small cap index, is the Russell has a systematic counting system where there is no input from a committee. They just say anything that is the below the 1,000th name to the 3,000th name is a small cap name. That's not how S&P does it. They have a committee that selects 600 names that they think represents the small cap asset class. How does that manifest itself? Well, you get about 50% of the portfolio in mid caps, and you get about 47% of the portfolio in small caps. The fund we looked at the other day even had like 20% in large caps. So be aware that when you see this S&P Small Cap 600, I wouldn't necessarily call it a small cap portfolio. Now, you are saying you want to get exposure to energy by staying away from some of the big guys, and it certainly does do that, right? It tilts towards mid-caps, 50% of the portfolio, 47% small caps, 0% of the weight in the large caps. Now, it does that for a relatively expensive expense ratio, given it's a U.S. fund, 29 basis points, and it's not doing much other than just tilting towards those stocks. It holds about 34 names. The top 10 make up about 54% of the portfolio. It looks like it's pretty heavily weighted towards oil and gas, fossil fuel exploration, coal and uranium mining. You know, overall, I think it's good to get some of that smaller exposure. The reason being, over longer periods of time, smaller cap stocks, mid cap stocks tend to outperform larger ones, especially in this space, right? Where the small and the large ones tend, or the small and the mid caps tend to be the ones where there's a lot of growth. One thing that I guess I worry about if you're looking for growth within a fund like this is it's still tilted a lot towards fossil fuel oil and gas exploration and operations. Not a lot of uranium exposure. Only about 9% is from coal and uranium mining. So I don't know what portion of that is coal. So I'm not seeing a lot of exposure to more the more growthy areas of the energy sector, at least what you've seen be big growers over the past couple of years. So my advice would be, if you're trying to get small cap energy exposure, I would look for a fund that is more concentrated on doing screens off of something like the Russell 2000, because you're going to actually get true small cap exposure, whereas this is a small mid cap fund. Either way, you have the right idea. You're looking for those companies that tend to grow more over time. Keep up the good work. That is the Invesco S&P Small Cap Energy ETF, ticker PSCE. Thanks for the call. And before we head to a break, I want to remind you once again that we have an upcoming wealth webinar set for September 30th. That wealth webinar will be about AI and not about the things that have been talked about most often, your NVIDIAs of the world, your chip makers, but really the picks and shovels, the energy infrastructure names, the industrial infrastructure names, the types of companies that are going to benefit beyond from the production and the demand for chips, but really from the implementation itself. So if that sounds interesting, Justin and I would love for you to join us on September 30th. As always, we will have a live Q&A afterwards where we'll answer all of your questions, be them about AI or about investing more broadly. This is InvestTalk. I'm Luke Greer. We have one goal here: to help you achieve your financial freedom. Our work continues after our final break, so get your questions in now at 888-99-CHART.
'24/7, rain or shine, there's always value in the InvestTalk podcast. 888-99-CHART.
I'm thinking to add some international stocks to my portfolio, so I'm interested to buy this single ETF, VT, in my Roth IRA. So what do you think about this ETF, VT? Thank you so much.
VT is the Vanguard Total World Stock ETF. It is exactly what it sounds like. It's a passively managed fund, holds a well-diversified market cap weighted portfolio of both developed and emerging market stocks, ignoring the frontier markets, and has a little bit of certain exclusions there as well, given market size. Now, it's 84% large cap, 10% mid cap, 3% small cap. But if you're looking for international exposure, I don't think that this is exactly where you want to be, because 44% of the revenue comes from the United States. The top companies are NVIDIA, Microsoft, Apple, Alphabet, Amazon. This is a total market ETF. I think what you want to look for is something that is more focused on international markets, give you that broad international diversification. If you're a passive investor, which it sounds like you are, the Vanguard family is a good way to go, because they tend to be low expense ratios, broadly diversified, and not overly complex or confusing. Maybe look elsewhere within that suite of funds. That is VT, the Vanguard Total World Stock ETF. All right, before we head off, let's talk a little bit about what Jerome Powell said today. Called the Fed's stance still modestly restrictive even after last week's cut, leaving room for more easing if the labor market continues to soften. Now, Powell also stressed the Fed's dual mandate, as he has over the past couple of years, being that they're supposed to both control inflation and promote a healthy job market, noting that there is no risk-free path between the two. Doing action for one tends to affect others. Cutting too aggressively and inflation risks staying closer to 3% rather than the 2% target. Stay too tight and jobs will suffer unnecessarily. Now, the chairman repeated that job growth in the summer did slow pretty sharply. The economy failed to create enough jobs to match the labor force. He also avoided pre-committing to October's meeting, but didn't push back on markets' expectation that there will be a cut there. Tariff hikes, he said, will cause one-time price increases that ripple gradually, but the Fed must ensure that they don't turn into lasting inflation. Now, projections from last week showed a narrow majority of officials penciling in two more cuts this year, pointing to October and December, the final two meetings. Still, divisions remain inside the Fed. Powell faces challenges of keeping colleagues aligned if data sends mixed signals, as well as political pressure, which is intensifying. Trump and Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent accused the Fed of being timid, while Trump has even tried to fire Fed Governor Lisa Cook, that is tied up in a bit of litigation at the moment. Now, for now, courts have allowed Lisa Cook to remain on the Fed board, though the administration is pushing the Supreme Court to take back her removal. And certainly if she is gone, well, that's one more vote. Who knows how she would vote? She actually seemed to be a bit more in favor of cuts in previous meetings. But still, that could mean that the president gets another member on the board of governors. Now, Powell didn't wade directly into politics, understanding that that's not his job, but did defend the Fed's independence, calling accusations of partisanship unfounded. This speech certainly didn't provide much new news, right? It's a lot of what we've heard. We have heard for quite some time. Jerome Powell protecting Fed independence, saying they're going to be data dependent, saying they got to worry about the labor market, saying that there's going to be inflation moving forward. And so as expected, right, we're not seeing much of a market reaction here. But he did remind listeners that despite crises in 2008 and 2020, the U.S. economy often continued to outperform peers, underscoring the Fed's broader track record in spite of what has happened over the past 5 years. That concludes another episode of Invest Talk. Justin and I thank you for listening and encourage you to tell your friends and family members about our free podcast downloads, which you can get at iTunes and Spotify. We also encourage you to check out our YouTube videos over on our YouTube channel. Just search Invest Talk with two T's. We do offer YouTube-specific content. It's where we host our webinars. It's where we post our webinars. We have the InvestTalk Classroom Series that teaches you evergreen lessons. We also have the InvestTalk Innovators Series, where Justin and I talk to innovators within the business community. If any of that sounds interesting, please check it out and bring along at least one friend or family member to do so as well. Today's show made you think about your financial picture, your investment, your taxes, your retirement, and whether it's all really working together. Justin and I would love to speak with you because at KPP Financial, we offer no-cost portfolio reviews to help bring clarity and confidence. If that sounds interesting, head over to investark.com and click on the portfolio review button. Independent thinking, shared success. This is InvestTalk. Good night.
InvestTalk is a trademark of KPP Financial. Because of the nature of the interactive dialogue inherent in the format of this program, it's important for the listener to understand that not all comments made will apply to them. Specifically, nothing said shall be taken to be investment advice, or shall statements on this program be considered an offer to buy or sell security. Because such advice is rendered solely on an individual basis, and at times will require that the investor review a prospectus before investing. InvestTalk is a copyrighted program of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial, a registered investment advisor firm, which retains all rights. For more information regarding KPP's investment advisors, call 1-800-557-5461. Thank you for listening, and your comments and questions are welcome on our 24-hour listener line at 888-99-CHART.